for this must be the green peppers which had been served with their rice while supplies lasted. There had been no other significant differences in diet. The prolonged calm and attendant sickness brought out different things in people, depending on temperament and circumstances. To the inward-looking Paris, with his abiding sense of guilt, the stagnation was also moral, and he was prey to depression and morbid imaginings. The people of the crew, less privileged in respect to space, grew more quarrelsome among themselves and more resentful of those set over them. Haynes and Barton still drove the men, but they went more warily and kept a loaded pistol at their belts. Thurso, too, went armed, aware of the feeling against him. The captain was living in a purgatory of his own. He took his meals generally alone, in sombre silence. When on deck he spoke only through Barton. His small, raw-veined eyes darted suspicious glances from under their heavy brows, as if seeking in the faces of those around him some clue as to the culprit, the killer of his merchandise, the agent of this blighting calm. He conveyed to Paris a definite impression of derangement. Only Delblanc seemed largely unaffected, though this was a mistaken impression, as Paris came afterwards to realize. In fact, in this succession of unchanging days, Delblanc changed more profoundly than anyone, though this was not obvious at the time, because he seemed merely to become more definitely himself. Scrupulously shaved, his hair dressed carefully, in cambric shirt and elegant close-fitting breeches, he moved about the ship, talking in his frank and engaging style to any of the crew with leisure to listen. What reflections he made in the silence of his cabin, and how far he seriously attempted to foment revolt, or even hoped for it, was never made clear. He did not himself declare it. But there is no doubt that in this waste of sea, as the ship dragged her stench through the water, and dead negroes continued to be cast over the side, Delblanc underwent a sort of conversion, of profound consequence for all of them, slaves and seamen alike. And the first sign of it was the way he sought to make converts. A man may go through life and remain ignorant of himself. He may think himself as other than he truly is, and he may die with this illusion still intact, because no circumstance of his life has obliged him to revise it. Perhaps this is true for most of us. Delblanc had regarded himself as an artist of a sort, a drifting person, rather a failure. He had espoused theories of liberty and equality, as many do who feel they have made no mark on the world, but these had been diluted in society at large, and by his own diffidence. Now, in the present circumstances of the ship, he found a world reduced, concentrated, the perfect model of a tyranny. He was driven to question his life's purposes. Quite frequently, on some corner of the deck, or in Delblanc's more spacious cabin, he and the surgeon would continue the discussions that had begun with their first meeting. Paris's liking for the other persisted, grew stronger. There was a warmth, a personal attractiveness about him, and a patent sincerity impossible to resist. Even without this, Delblanc would always have held a special place in his affection and regard. It was to Delblanc that he had laid bare his soul that night at the fort, in the moonlit room, with the death mask of the governor seeming to follow his every word and movement. However, they could never altogether agree. Delblanc's contention was that any people, any nation or group, could change their condition immediately and radically by changing their habits of mind. "Let the most oppressed people under heaven once change their thinking, and they are free," he said, his brown eyes shining with that extraordinary openness and undefendedness of expression, his hands, which were shapely and strong, gesturing sharply. He had recently developed a habit of gesture curiously at odds with the gentlemanly nonchalance of his bearing, abrupt, almost fierce, controlling and delimiting, cutting off possible dissent. "Even these people on the ship," he said, "both black and white, for they are imprisoned both." And Paris, weary and oppressed, suffering these days from a sort of feverish insomnia, would marvel at this pristine shine of Delblanc's, the freshness of his face and clothes, his philosophical impressment, the increasing eagerness of his manner, in which, though this was not to occur to the surgeon until later, there were already the signs of that fanaticism which would so profoundly affect them all. "We can change our situation by thinking, you say," Paris would reply. But whence comes this faith of yours that thinking can be changed? You are like a man who wants to build the upstairs rooms before he is sure of the foundations. Do you believe that habits of mind can be so easily reversed? For myself, I do not believe so. If ideas are not innate, and they are not, they cannot be so deeply lodged as to be beyond uprooting, D'Alblon would say, with one of his eager, delimiting gestures. It is only a question of supplanting one set of associations with another. I am convinced of it. I know it in my heart and mind, Paris. Man can live free and not seek to limit the freedom of others, so long as no one seeks to limit his. So these discussions between them took usually an accustomed course. But D'Alblon's sense of mission was growing, and he did not limit himself to Paris, anyone at all. The weasel-faced Tapley swabbing down the decks, a disgruntled Billy Blair coming up from scraping the slaves' quarters, Morgan in his galley trying to find some new disguise for the rotten beef, might find himself addressed by D'Alblon and asked whether he did not agree that the state of society was artificial and the power of one man over another merely derived from convention. D'Alblon's manner was the same with all, friendly and open. At first, tactics lagging behind conviction, he made no concession to any imperfections of understanding in his audience. "By nature we are equal," he said on one occasion to a vacantly smiling Cali. "Does it not therefore follow that government must always depend on the consent of the governed?" He was bookish, and he used the language he knew. He even spoke to McGann, asking him whether he did not think it true that the character of man originated in external circumstances and could be changed as these were changed. The men listened, or appeared to listen, out of deference, because he was a gentleman, because he was paying for his passage. D'Alblon saw soon enough that he was using the wrong language with them, and was beginning to try out a different one, until warned by Thurzo, in terms not very civil, that if he persisted in thus distracting the crew, he would be confined to his quarters for the rest of the voyage.
"I will silence his blabbing," he swore to Barton. "I will board him up in his cabin."
This proved unnecessary. One look at the captain's face was enough to convince D'Alblon. It was in his reaction to this threat that he showed the quick grasp of realities that later came to distinguish him. A man can do no good locked up in his cabin. He went more circumspectly thereafter. In this he was wise. Thurzo's punishments now were mere savagery. There was no pretense of justice in them. Davis, elected as spokesman, went aft to complain about the quality of the beef, which was offensive to the smell and visibly putrid. Though he spoke respectfully and kept his eyes down, he had hardly got out a dozen words before Thurzo, in an access of fury, had him seized up to the gratings and flogged him with a rope's end, groaning and panting himself with the force of the blows, only desisting when obliged by exhaustion.
"Davies will never forgive it," Sullivan confided to Paris. "Never, not if he lives to be 100. He feels it was not deserved. Davis is a steady man. That is why he was chose, and he spoke to the captain fair. It would have been the cat, but Thurzo couldn't wait for it to be fetched. He was in such haste for bloodletting."
"These are difficult days," Paris said. He had made it a point of principle not to join in any direct criticism of the captain. Sullivan hesitated briefly, then said,
"I know it is not my place to speak, but there is bad will building up towards the captain and the mate."
Again he checked, this time for longer. His next words came in a rush.
"I don't care a farthing what befalls Thurzo. He has treated us worse than the blacks. But you stand close to him, Mr. Paris, because you are related to the owner, begging your pardon. I wanted to say you should keep a weather eye open."
"Thank you. I will remember it," Paris said. Sullivan gave his gap-toothed smile, relieved that his words had not been resented. Ever since the surgeon had spoken kindly to him in the manner of dancing the slaves, he had felt a loyal affection for Paris. He had come partly to utter the warning, partly to ask a favour. He wanted Paris to act as witness for him.
"McGann will not believe I did it," he said. "We had a shilling on it. McGann bet me a shilling that I would not dare to face Thurzo. Well, he knows I went. But the miscreated Caledonian pretends not to believe I spoke as I did."
Sullivan shook his head at McGann's obduracy, and his long, unkempt black hair swung round his face.
"He says he won't part with his shilling till he gets proof it was me music I spoke of to Terzo, and the fact that I could not hear myself playing owing to the clanking of the chains."
"Yes, I see." Paris saw from the other's expression that this was a serious matter for him. Sullivan was naked to the waist and terribly thin now, the bones of his shoulder standing out clearly, but his eyes had the usual look of glancing after some vision of splendour glimpsed and lost only moments before. "I don't believe McGann has a shilling," the surgeon said after a moment. "He hasn't had any wages, has he? You will remember that he came aboard in rags and every stitch was taken off him and burned."
"I remember it well. They done the exact self-same thing with me, only I was turned out smarter than McGann by far. I had a good coat on me with a set of brass buttons. Them buttons have never, to this day, been given back."
"I didn't know that. But I wanted to say that if McGann came aboard with nothing..."
"It is not for the sake of the money,"
Sullivan said.
"If it was the money, he could give me a note of hand. I know something of the law, being a travelled man, and I know a note of hand is legal tender. But then again, what is the use of waving a note of hand about when there is never a drop left in the bottle? No, he has got to admit that I won the bet. That is all I am asking. McGann has the scurvy, very bad. He could drop off tomorrow. I have seen men go sudden with that, joking one minute and dead the next, and McGann is beginning to have the look of it about him. The matter must be set straight before he goes. That is what we mean by justice, Mr. Paris. And I thought, since you were present and heard what passed, you might find it in you to tell McGann how I put my request to the captain with a firm voice, and meanwhile looking him straight in the eye."
"Very well," said Paris. "It can do no harm to try. I will confine myself to your actual words, I think, and leave McGann to imagine how you bore yourself." But before he found an opportunity for this, McGann had been put in irons for begging rice from the bowls of the negroes. These last would sometimes give food to the men who had so ill-used them, a charity mysterious and moving to Paris, but rousing the captain to particular rage, as tending to weaken the slaves further and reduce their chances of survival. The surgeon had to make his way forward in order to see McGann, past the slaves grouped together on the main deck, guarded at present by Wilson, Lees and Hughes, armed with whips and weighted sticks. Thurso had ceased to issue small arms to the crew. The men's slaves were still fettered in pairs, the women and boys and girls allowed free. Paris noted in passing that the woman from the fort was there among them, that she seemed well enough, though emaciated. He had learned from Jimmy that she was not from the Gold Coast at all, but much further west. She was from a people of nomads called Fulani, who lived by herding cattle. She did not look at him now as he went by. McGann sat in his heavy leg irons on the forecastle deck. He listened to Paris's testimony with head lowered, the ragged cap drawn down over his brows. The pale, yellowish hue that had marked his face at first had darkened now, and he had visible difficulty in breathing. Paris took the opportunity to look again at the blotches on his legs, and found that they had degenerated into ulcerous wounds. "That is what passed," the surgeon said. "I was present at the time, and I heard Sullivan say the words. He asked me to come and tell you so that you'd be satisfied he had won the wager fairly." McGann glanced up at him. There was a blankness now in his gaze, but the lines of his face were set in their old expression of dogged and fruitless calculation.
"You're on Sullivan's side, then," he said, his breath wheezed. "I'm not done out of a shilling, so easy. Put in a word with Thurso for me. Get me out of these irons, and you can hear the money."
"I have already asked Captain Thurso to free you," Paris said gently. "I will ask him again, in any case. It does not depend on what you decide to do about your bet with Sullivan." Whether McGann believed this or not, Paris never knew. He made no reply at the time, merely lowered his head with a sort of bitter obstinacy. He remained in irons all night, despite the surgeon's pleas. He was still alive and able to talk when Haynes went to strike off his fetters, but when they began to help him to his feet, he groaned loudly once and fell dead to the deck. Within an hour he had been sewn in canvas and weighted, and committed with the scantiest of ceremonies to the sea. 2 days later, there was a change for the better in the weather, raising the spirits of all, though it was to prove no more than a respite, the crueller for its promise. A fair wind sprang up from the east, variable at first, then settling. The Liverpool merchant made good way, tacking to begin with so as to take best advantage of the breezes. The fair spell coincided with a lull in the progress of the dysentery. For 9 days there were no deaths. However, the slaves were much weakened, and when they were got up on deck for washing, a number of them could not stand without support, despite whipping. Losses had been considerable. According to Barton, whose task it was to keep the tally, 76 Negroes had died aboard ship since they had taken on their first slaves at Sierra Leone. In spite of this, Thurza seemed in better mood now that the weather had quickened. He invited Paris and Del Blanc to sup with him, Barton making the fourth. There was still part of a side of fresher beef taken on board ready salted at Cape Palmas and reserved for captain and officers. This was minced with biscuit, onions and rice to make a stew. Over it, and a bottle from his stock of Bordeaux, Thurza became communicative, informing the others that the longitude of Kingston, Jamaica, by Dr. Halley's chart, was 76 degrees and 30 minutes from London, and that they were therefore, by his reckoning, 142 leagues from it, provided he was right in his computation of the longitude of Cape St. Anne. And as he squared his shoulders and stuffed his pipe with the rank black tobacco and glared before him at a possibly relenting demon, everything about the captain's manner indicated his belief that the computation was indeed correct. Paris, still worried about the presence of scurvy aboard, took advantage of this better mood to ask the captain for some of his claret to dilute and serve out to the crew.
"My claret!"
Thurza looked at him with genuine astonishment.
"Your wits have gone astray altogether, Mr. Paris. I'm to give up my claret for that mutinous scum in the forecastle?"
"McGann died of scurvy," Paris said, "and there are three others who show signs of it. It is due to some lack of nutriment. I thought perhaps the wine might do something. It is the juice of the grape, after all. I thought I might mull it with a little sugar and some dried sage that I have."
"Did you so? I'm obliged to you for thus disposing of my wine. McGann was a pox-ridden little beast, and he died because there was no more marrow left in his bones. There is nothing wrong with salt beef. Our navy has fed on it for centuries. Why are all the crew not down with scurvy if it's owing to the food? They've all eaten the same."
"That I do not know exactly," Paris said.
"Oh, so there is something you do not know. Take my word, those three you mention are dragging their feet. If I catch any man scanting his work, he will get a good dozen. What he will not get, Mr. Paris, is any of the captain's wine."
This was final enough and left no grounds for appeal. Paris was driven to ponder again on the green peppers that had been served to the Negroes. Without speaking of it to anyone, he took a bag of dried peas from the stores and kept them rinsed in his cabin until they produced shoots. These he persuaded Morgan to add to the men's lobscouse just before serving, but as things turned out, he was not allowed time enough to detect any improvement, nor indeed to continue very long with his cultivation. Hughes, the climber, high in the rigging, saw long-tailed tropic birds above him and shoals of brightly coloured sunfish below, signs that they were coming into more enclosed waters. He saw also, full in the wind's eye, a luminous halo on the edge of a distant cloud, and knew it for the precursor of stormy weather. But the storm, when it came, struck with such suddenness that they had barely time to get the slaves battened down between decks. The ship staggered with the shock of a huge sea that seemed to rise on them from nowhere. The tornado that accompanied it came from eastward and attacked with awesome force and fury. Above the creaking and straining of the ship, Haynes bellowed for all hands. Thurso stood at the mainmast beside Barton, who bawled out the captain's orders. The men at the clue lines struggled to hoist the stubborn, thundering canvas to the yards. Up above, Hughes and Wilson and Kavanagh and Blair, swinging on the crosspieces while the ship reeled below them, fought to subdue the topsails and get them furled. The men were debilitated, but the habit of discipline and the long practice of endurance kept them to the work, and with surprising speed the ship was hove to under reefed fore and main topsails. Thereafter she was driven by heavy squalls that struck at her repeatedly, with scarcely a pause. For 6 days the slaves could not be brought on deck. Their meals were served below in lulls between the squalls. Because of the rough seas and heavy rain, the air ports set along the sides of the ship between decks had to be closed and tarpaulins thrown over the gratings, thus effectively cutting off all the means by which air could be admitted. The sufferings of the Negroes, already weakened by their privations and many of them with dysentery, were of the most appalling kind. Their rooms soon became insufferably hot. The confined air grew stifling through lack of oxygen and noxious with the breathing and sweating and excreting of so many bodies so close together. There was little more than 2 feet of headroom, and the boards they lay in were of unplaned plank, so that they rolled helplessly in the hot, suffocating darkness. The rough surface of the wood took the skin from their backs and sides. In lapses of the wind, Paris held calls for help come from them, and wild, demented cries. Sometimes he saw steam rise through the gratings. Several times, when conditions permitted, he went down among them, accompanied always by 3 men, one to hold a lamp, the others carrying loaded sticks to prevent the slaves from biting at their legs and ankles. To Paris, the place seemed like some infernal slaughterhouse. The floor of the rooms was slippery with the blood and mucus that had resulted from the dysentery, making the footing hazardous. He brought bread, soaked in water, to refresh the slaves, and tried to discover any who had fainted so that they might be brought up and revived. He always pulled off his shirt before going down, but he could never stand the heat for very long. On the last occasion, he was already feeling sick and feverish before descending. After no more than 10 minutes, he was so overcome with the heat and stench and foul air that his senses swam, and he would have fallen had it not been for the assistance of the men with him. This heralded a bout of the fever which had visited him earlier in the voyage. For a day and a night he lay in his cabin, sweating, shivering, sleeping in troubled snatches, while the squalls slowly grew less violent and the weather began to settle again. It was while he lay thus that Thurzo had his idea. It was a simple idea, but Thurzo was a simple man, being an incarnation, really, of the profit motive, than which there can be few things simpler. His idea was based on certain undeniable facts. Deaths among the Negroes during the 6 days of bad weather had amounted to 18, 10 men, 5 women, and 3 boys. The ship had been blown considerably off course, and a good number more were likely to die before Jamaica was reached. Those that survived would not look attractive to the planters that came to bid for them. Cargo dying aboard ship of so-called natural causes was quite worthless, whereas cargo cast overboard for good and sufficient reason could be classed as lawful jetsam, and 30% of the market value could then be claimed from the insurers. There was also the fact that Paris, who might otherwise have given trouble, need not be consulted, as he was at present confined to his cabin with fever, and with luck would continue so some time longer. With real luck, Thurzo thought darkly, he would die of it. These facts, in synthesis, were present to the captain's mind as he sat alone in his cabin over his brandy. His counsellor, it seemed, had not altogether deserted him, but returned and spoke to him now again. It was for the last time. The counsel was more than rational. It was virtuous. Thurzo knew he had nothing much to gain. Only Kemp would benefit from the insurance money. He knew he would be retiring at the end of this voyage. He had money saved. He had a 3/4 share in the gold dust purchased with Barton. The Negroes could live or die. It would not much matter to him. But he had his reputation to think of. He had always, throughout his long career, done everything in his power to give satisfaction to his owners. Mindful of the need for lawful proceeding, he called Barton, Haynes, Davis and Barber to his cabin, these being the only men surviving with any status on the ship. The results of this nocturnal conference were what Paris woke to in the early morning. He felt light-headed and insubstantial, but free of fever. He sensed that the ship was listing slightly, and guessed there had been some displacement in her hold. As he lay there, not fully awake yet, but grateful for the calmer weather and his restored clarity, he heard a series of sounds quite inexplicable. A heavy clatter of chains on the deck somewhere above him, then running steps of several men together, a single cry, sustained and strangely exultant, brief splashing to starboard. Before he could believe he was properly awake, it came again. The clattering of chains on the deck, it sounded like fetters falling. He had heard no voices other than that single cry. Possessed by nothing stronger than curiosity at first, and a sort of disbelief, like a man following clues in a dream, he got to his feet, dressed as hastily as his weakness allowed, and made his way up to the deck. In all the years of his life remaining, Paris was to carry the impression of that emergence into light and space. It was to accompany his days, glimpsed again and again in the wake of experiences of a certain kind, increases of light, intimations of freedom, a sort of puzzlement, too. He could not at first understand what was happening. He was bewildered by the placid sea and sky, a sky enormous and blank, sheltering and condoning everything. His first impression was of a fight in progress. Haynes and Libby were half facing each other with something of the wrestler's crouch in their posture. Thurzo and Barton stood on either side, like seconds in a duel. Perhaps a dozen men, armed with the same short, heavy sticks, made a semicircle around them, as if to make sure neither combatant broke free. But it was no fight, he saw now. There were no combatants. Two naked male slaves stood together, side by side, unchained, up against the ship's rail. He heard Thurzo utter some words. Haynes and Libby moved towards the Negroes, joined now by Wilson. Three powerful men. The slaves were about to be manhandled over the side. Others had gone before them. It was what he had heard. That sound. They had taken the chains off them. Chains had a value. Still, all the people were absorbed in the business. No one had seen him yet. One of the Negroes stood straight and impassive, but the other had given way to fear. He had brought his hands up to plead for him and thrust forward his head as if to make an obeisance before his oppressors. It was a posture beast-like, baited, derided, and Paris recognized it. All thought of consequences departed from him. "No!" he shouted. "No!" He began to move rapidly towards them across the deck. Obeying an obscure impulse, he raised his right arm to the fullest extent, as if in witness. With all the strength of his lungs, aiming his voice at the sky, he shouted again, "No!" Chapter 36. Erasmus expressed his belief that the ship was to blame some days later, in the course of his final interview with the man who was to have been his father-in-law. In the passion of it, he came near to betraying his father altogether. "It preyed on his mind," he said, white-faced, hot-eyed, dressed impeccably in his suit of mourning velvet and his white stock. As the full extent of the financial disaster was borne in upon him, he had grown more than ever fastidious in his dress and person. Washing frequently and changing his linen twice a day, he had taken also to the fashion of powdering his hair.
"It was the failure of his hopes in the ship," he said, that led to the seizure.
If Wolpert noticed anything in the altered form of words or the brief hesitation, he gave no sign of it. He thought it odd for the young man to attribute his father's death to such a minor cause of worry. Odd and excessive, but Erasmus's nature went to extremes. In that, he was like his father, who had just proved it again, Wolpert thought wryly, by the magnitude of his debts. 20 shiploads of slaves would not have saved Kemp, in the pass his affairs had come to. So much was common knowledge now.
"The ship is not late enough yet to be given up as lost," he said. "It is hardly more than a year since she sailed, and the trading is slow at present on the Guinea coast. Your father would have known that."
He had spoken to defend the father's reason against this judgment of the son, moved by a kind of pity for both. But the stiff composure of the young man's face did not change. He seemed to brace his shoulders more, as if sensing and rejecting the intention of kindness in the older man's words.
"The ship left Africa 6 months ago," he said coldly. "We had letters. We had a letter from the captain."
"Your cousin is with the ship, I understand," Wolpert said. Kemp had let this fall one day when they had been talking together in the street.
"He will be hard hit by this. Kemp was his benefactor."
Erasmus himself had never mentioned his cousin. It seemed he would make no response now, save for a brief nod. But after a moment he said,
"I believe the ship is lost, and my cousin with her."
Wolpert sighed and put his heavy hands together on the desk before him.
"We must come to the point," he said. "None of this is your fault,
but naturally it has changed things. When we talk of losses, it is seldom useful to consider where the fault lies. He paused again, looking at the set, expressionless face before him. He had never really warmed to Erasmus Kemp, noting always something relentless and oppressive in him, even in his visible devotion to Sarah. But he had grown to respect the young man's energy and ambition, and he felt more kindly disposed to him now, when he was left with nothing but these, than perhaps ever before.
"Your mother has some means of her own, I believe," he said. "She has a small income from capital left in trust by her father. She will not remain long in the house there, I suppose."
"No, sir. The house is to be sold, and all in it. She proposes to go to her sister in Norfolk.
She has impressed us all by her fortitude in this tragic loss."
A certain delicacy prevented Walpert from saying more than this. It was years since he had seen Elizabeth Kemp with such spring in her step and colour in her cheeks.
"I am heartily sorry to see you both brought to this," he continued after a moment. "In what I am about to say now, there is no blame for you. You could not have suspected the extent of your father's losses, and particularly his unlucky investments of these last months.
There were signs, if I had but heeded them."
He would not suffer this stranger to distribute degrees of blame.
"I was taken up with my own affairs," he said.
Walpert shrugged a little.
"That is only natural," he said. "But it is about those same affairs I'm afraid we must speak now. It will be obvious to you that there cannot, in the present circumstances, be any contract of marriage with my daughter. There can be no question of an engagement, either official or otherwise, or any sort of an agreement or understanding which would place you in a special relation to her. You will understand that clearly, I hope."
"I had understood it already," the young man said, and made to get up.
"One moment." Walpert raised a hand. "I've not yet finished.
These debts are not yours. They were incurred by the firm of Kemp, in which you had not yet become a partner. The creditors will recover what they can, and that will be the end of the matter as far as—"
"No, sir, excuse me. It shall not be the end.
Pray allow me to finish. I have been impressed by your abilities. I am prepared to offer you a place in the family firm at a salary to be agreed on. £30 a year was what I had in mind. I think you will agree that is not ungenerous. You would be an assistant to my son Charles, who conducts the transport side of the business. There is no need for you to answer at once, but I am sure that the briefest consideration will reveal the advantages of the offer." "To a pauper, such an offer must have obvious advantages," Erasmus said with a bitter twist of the lips.
He remained silent for some moments, then rose to his feet.
"I have no need of time to consider," he said, standing very straight. "I thank you for your offer, but I must refuse it. Your kindness requires I should explain why. I cannot agree with what you say about the debts my father has left. My father's debts are mine, whether I am legally responsible for them or not. I intend to clear his name and discharge the bankruptcy. All the creditors shall be repaid in full, with due interest. I cannot do this on the salary you offer. No, not if you tripled it."
Walpert sat still for some moments, taken by surprise.
"Well," he said at last, in a tone of some displeasure, getting up in his turn, "you know your own business best, I suppose."
In fact, he did not at all suppose it at the moment. There was nothing at all quixotic in the merchant's outlook on life. Debts were the business of those who had contracted them. That Erasmus would persist in this, he did not believe, not even that the intention would outlast the rawness of his loss. It was the young man's high-handedness that had nettled him, as on occasion before. Below this lay a certain relief. He had done his duty, and Erasmus might have made a difficult subordinate. There was little left to say between them now. There never had been much.
"You have my good wishes, in any case," Walpert said as they shook hands. "My daughter expressed the wish to see you. She is waiting for you in the small parlour across the hall."
He found her standing against the tall window that looked over the terrace and the long slope of the grounds towards the lake. She made a movement towards him as he entered, but checked on seeing how straight and still he stood there, just inside the door.
"Your father said I should find you here," he said.
He had prepared himself for this interview, rehearsed it. The need to conduct himself properly took all feeling from his voice. 3 days before, in the secrecy of his room, in the house that no longer belonged to them, he had wept for Sarah until he was feverish. There were no tears left in him now. She waited a moment, then said, "You have refused, I take it?"
"Refused?"
"My father's offer. You have refused it." She was standing against the light. He did not feel that he was seeing her clearly. His eyes felt strangely weak, perhaps with a constant effort of these last days to show the world a clear and defiant regard. He blinked to focus them. He saw Sarah turn her head to one side. There was some movement in the line of her shoulder as she stood in her summer dress against the light, and he knew that she was crying.
"So that was your idea, then?" he said. "You set your father onto it."
"Do you think he's a man to be set on?"
The tears were in her voice. Why was she crying?
It seemed to him that all the loss was his. "No," he said, with an odd attempt at judiciousness, "I don't think that. But you asked him this favour. He doesn't refuse you anything, does he?"
It sounded like a jibe, though he had spoken gravely.
"Weighing bales and measuring the width of cartwheels for Charles Walpert," he said after a moment.
"It would have been a way for us."
There was an attempt now, in spite of her distress, at the angry sarcasm she kept for quarrels.
"He would not take favours," she said. "Oh, no, not Erasmus Kemp. This was not a favour, either. My father knows your worth. You did not think of me, not for one moment."
"A way?"
He could not understand what she meant.
"I would take favours," he said with a sudden passionate intensity. "I would take any means to restore his good name. When I asked him, when I told him my feelings and asked his permission to marry, and he consented, he said that he and I were different, that we had different characters. He said he would stop to look at something, but I would keep on with it until it had grown so that it couldn't be changed or touched. But it wasn't true. We are the same."
He raised one arm in a stiff gesture of emphasis.
"He let this grow until he couldn't touch it anywhere. It wasn't possible for him to disentangle one thing from another, so the ship came to stand for everything."
"I have been mistaken," he heard her say in low tones. "I supposed you would fight to keep me, for the hope of not losing me. I thought it would be something to keep your heart up in this terrible time, if you knew that I didn't give you up. In spite of everything, that I would wait." She paused, then said, in a tone of wonder almost,
"You have not thought of me at all."
"I am not the same as I was," he said. "We cannot marry now. It is over. I have lost everything."
At this, she came quickly towards him, placed her hands on his rigid shoulders, looked up into his face.
"Not everything," she said. "Not everything."
But she faltered at the set cast of his features, the bright, abstracted stare. He was not seeing her.
"I don't want to be thought different from him," he said. "There is something else I remember him saying."
He had made no move to take her in his arms or touch her in any way, and after a moment she turned aside from him. Feeling the touch withdrawn, watching her move away, his loss was bitter to him. He had felt for that moment all the essence of promise in her, the warmth of her hands on him, the uncertain tenderness of her breath, the wide, undefended look of her eyes. Her words were brave, but he knew she was wrong. She was deceiving herself. He had lost everything. He said,
"He told me he should never have gone into cotton. He began in sugar, you know."
He was silent for some moments. He did not know what to talk about. There was nothing to say. She was part now of the debts and losses, part of the restitution he had to make. He was making a start with her.
"I intend to put that right," he said. "I intend to go into sugar."
"You will do as you please," she said.
"Nothing anyone else says will make a farthing of difference to you. I know that well. Everyone knows it." This calling of the world to witness was something she did often in argument, but her voice quivered now with the first real pain she had ever had to deal with alone.
"When you first began coming, When you looked at me so, I did not find you agreeable at all. I thought you overbearing and farouche, and everybody thought it too. Then you ruined the whole play, and you knew that I so much wanted to be in it, and I thought that it meant you cared more for me than you cared about pleasing me, and this was different from the other young men that talked to me. I know now that I was a fool to think it. It was pleasing yourself that you were set on. He did not know how to answer her, nor why she was reviving past complaints, when there was only this overwhelming present of his poverty. It was as if she was speaking in a language he was not fully familiar with.
"It is a simple matter enough," he said. "Your father has forbidden the match. I cannot go against him. I've been left without a penny. I have nothing to offer you."
"No, Erasmus," she said, and her voice was clear and unfaltering now. "That is not the reason." Once more, for the last time, he saw on her face the expression he had always found both fascinating and disturbing, the half-closed eyes, the luminous pause before the words came, that brief contortion of the mouth, like a prelude to ecstasy. But the words, when they came, were sad with final knowledge. "It is not because you have nothing to offer me, but because you have nothing now to add me to." He felt anger at this. She had belittled his sacrifice. With a brief phrase of farewell, he turned away. She did not answer, but as he passed out of the room, she called loudly after him in a voice that returning tears had made inarticulate. Perhaps it was an attempt to call his name. The declarations had been made already in the course of these interviews with father and daughter, but they needed to be uttered in the shrine of his room, where loneliness and custom could bind them into the sanctity of a vow. As always, his possessions, things deeply familiar to him, acted on his sensibilities like objects of ritual. The fact that the house and most of its contents would soon be coming under the hammer gave force and fervour to his words, as a promise takes more poignant strength when uttered in the midst of danger and change. Kneeling at his bedside, while sparrows chirped their loves in the eaves over the window, he spoke to God and his silver spurs and the pistols on the wall and his mother's framed embroidery extolling the virtues of the meek. "Every penny." It was less than a whisper. There were only the slight plosive sounds of his dry and fervent lips, the click of tongue in the dry mouth. "I will restore my father's good name. I will go into sugar." Book 2, 1765, Part 8, Chapter 37. Sir William Templeton, His Majesty's principal secretary to the West India Office, was at his dressing table, still in turban and flowered banyan. His levy had scarcely begun. He had just dismissed, with promises, a half-pay naval officer, unemployed now that the wars with France were ended, who was seeking his influence with the Admiralty, but lacked the guineas necessary to assure it. His footman entered to announce the name of a gentleman on business waiting at present in the anteroom with the others, but not the sort to kick his heels long, the footman remarked. There was between servant and master a close understanding of mutual convenience.
"He would not be fobbed off," the footman said. "He has a short way with him, sir."
"Aye, and a long purse, you rascal, I make no doubt," his master said. "He must have shown you the lining of it for you to bring his name with this dispatch."
Briefly pleased with this piece of wit, he twitched thin lips in the looking-glass. His face was narrow and long, very pale beneath the crimson silk of his turban, with a mouth that turned up at the corners in an accidental simper, oddly at variance with the generally downward-sloping, lugubrious cast of his features. He knew who this visitor was, though he did not say so to the servant, whose eye was upon him keenly.
"Where the devil is my hot chocolate?" he said. "Why am I kept waiting in this fashion? Now is the time I need sustenance, sir, as I address myself to the business of the day. Get within and see to it, and send Bindman hither to me, so I may discuss with him what I shall be wearing."
"Yes, sir. And the gentleman?" "When you have seen to all that," Templeton said, with assumed carelessness, "you may admit this person." He spent the interval before his mirror. Entering, Erasmus Kemp saw the secretary's long face, gaudy with rouge just applied, but not smoothed in yet, looking fixedly at him in the glass, framed by the swimming or flying putti round the rim, and beyond this by the pale blue and rose pink stucco cornucopias round the arches of the recessed bedchamber. For some moments the two men regarded each other thus. Then Templeton rose and advanced with languid affability, taking short and mincing steps in his loose Turkish slippers.
"My dear sir, curse me, this is a pleasure," he said, holding out his hand. "Will you take a seat, sir? I trust you're well."
"Tolerably well, I thank you." Kemp regarded the secretary with a somberness the warmth of his welcome had done nothing to relax. The years had taken colour from his cheeks and compressed his lips with a certain grimness of endurance or denial, though it was not evident whether of claims from within or without. But the eyes were unchanged, narrow and very dark, with a piercing insistence of regard that verged always on the antagonistic. He was dressed faultlessly in a suit of dark brown velvet, set off by foams of lace at the neck and cuffs. His black hair was longer now, in accordance with the fashion. He wore it free of powder, caught in a dark red ribbon behind.
"We need not make a long business of this," he said. "I shall not encroach on your time more than is needful. You have affairs of state to look to."
"Cares of state, sir, I prefer to name them.
There is a neat epigram to be got out of that rhyme, but these days, alas, I have no time for composition. Do you scribble yourself, sir?"
"No.
One needs peace for it. You will not mind if I continue with my toilette? I am bidden to my Lady Everney's in the forenoon."
"Indeed. By all means, continue.
I would not have you disappoint Lady Everney." Templeton shot him a sharp glance in the mirror, but made no reply. He had begun touching in the paint with a small brush.
"You know me, and you know whom I represent," Kemp was beginning, "so there is no need for—"
A small negro page-boy in a white turban and surcoat came in bearing a sugar bowl, a steaming cup of chocolate, and a plate of wafers on a japanned tray.
"About time, my pretty fellow,"
Templeton said. "Set it down here beside me. You must learn to be sharper." The little boy smiled, and his eyes flashed eagerly. He had teeth of amazing perfection.
"He doesn't know much English as yet," Templeton said. "I haven't had him above 2 weeks. I got him at auction at St. George's Coffee House in the Strand. I gave the last one to my Lord Granville, who had taken a fancy for him. This one is even better-looking. One should buy them pockmarked, of course. It is more secure, but I like a smooth skin. Will you take some chocolate?"
"Thank you, no," Kemp said. "I have breakfasted but lately." This was not strictly true, as it was now mid-morning, but a certain kind of disgusted impatience was growing in him, and he had no wish to share more than was necessary with the man before him. The knowledge there was between them had to be shared, and the space of the room, and the stale air in it.
"So then," Templeton said to the negro boy, waving an irritable hand, "why are you waiting there? Shoo, shoo, shoo! Go!"
"I am come on the same grounds as last time," Kemp said in level tones. "Nothing of substance has been achieved on your part since then, in spite of the monies made over to you for your use as you thought fit."
"Ah, base metal, curse me, I knew we should soon come to money,"
Templeton said in a tone of disdain.
"Yes, sir, money," Kemp said with a slight smile. "You find it a wearisome topic, I dare say, but those who dispense it incline to take an interest in how it is used."
His disgust persisted. It was more for himself now. "I should have sent someone else," he thought, but he trusted no one. He knew that Templeton was frightened, and that his every gesture and inflection was assumed to disguise the fact. He knew more. He knew the man's circumstances, his connections, those who were in his interest, those who were in his pocket, his gambling debts, his taste for boys, his wife of the days before his preferment, alone and drunken in their country house, consoling herself with footmen. He was sick to the soul with his knowledge of Templeton. "No doubt it is perverse of them to press inquiry so far," he said dryly, "but there it is."
"You are sarcastic, sir. It is not true to say that nothing has been achieved. I have risked displeasure at court by resisting demands for increased sugar duties to swell the revenues. There has been no increase since they were raised to help finance the war with the French, and that is close on 4 years now."
He had spoken with indignation, real or assumed, but there was nothing assumed about the unsteadiness of his hands when he set down his cup.
"Not to have agreed then would have cost me my place. It would have branded me as unpatriotic," he said.
"If you will forgive me," Kemp said in the same level tones, "the duties would have been kept down in any case, even without your support. As you're aware, we have 53 members of the House of Commons voting in our interest directly, as well as some others whom we both know, whose pockets are affected one way or another. We are strong enough to turn the balance in Parliament on any West India business. It is not for the conduct of bills in the House that we need your interest. You know that well, I think, Sir William. We need your voice behind the scenes, in the Council, your urgent..." At this moment the valet entered, with garments draped over one arm, holding a long stick with a half a dozen wigs on it before him, like a lance.
"Ah, Bindman," Templeton said, grateful for the diversion. "Let us see now. I thought the claret-coloured suit, sir, with a silver stitching," the valet said, after a brief bow to Kemp, "and a silver wig to go with it. A dull-toned wig will not do well with silver threaded on wine-colour, especially seeing that the suit is satin and has a high shine to it."
He had spoken, as he was obviously accustomed to speak, in high-pitched, intimate tones, as if there were no one else present. He took some gliding steps into the bedchamber and laid the clothes on the bed.
"This one?"
he said, returning, lifting one of the wigs delicately from the stick. He had produced from his pocket a little powder bellows.
"Wait, you rogue!" Templeton said. "Why do you always hurry me so?"
"I would have this interview in private," Kemp said coldly. "I cannot speak to you while this fellow capers about with wigs."
Dignity required some delay in response to this. Templeton had commenced already to unfasten the high turban. He continued to do so, glancing at Kemp through the glass. Typical of the low-born fellow to be rendered uneasy by the presence of servants. Son of provincial bankrupt. The times were bad that could throw up such creatures into positions of power. Templeton had his own sources of information, and there was a file on Kemp in his office at the Ministry. He took in the careless, lounging posture of his visitor, a carelessness at odds with the tight lips, the insolent intensity of the eyes, a man who had come from nothing and nowhere. It was a career, meteoric, even in these times of opportunity for the clever and unscrupulous. He had begun as an employee of the firm of Thomas Fletcher, which carried on an extensive trade with Jamaica, dealing on the London Exchange in sugar grown on its own plantations and imported in its own ships. He had made himself useful to his employers in a number of ways, some of them on the edge of legality and some beyond. Templeton knew something of these last, though not enough to be useful. Kemp had been twice to Jamaica to increase the firm's holdings by bribing or intimidating local officials to sign foreclosure orders on small tenants who had fallen into arrears. These services, and others more nebulous, had brought him to a full partnership in 5 years. He had married Sugar, too, in the person of the daughter of Sir Hugo Gerald, whose merchant bank had been founded on his connections in the West India trade. Margaret Gerald had neither looks nor elegance, but had made up for both by the fortune she had brought, said to be £80,000. Kemp's present wealth could only be guessed at, but the most important fact about him, from Templeton's point of view, was that he had lately become vice-president of the West India Association, and could thus speak for the entire faction. The turban was removed now, and Templeton's long, nearly naked head stood revealed.
"Bindman is discretion itself," he said at last. "He has been with me these 5 years."
"He has been with me no more than 5 minutes, but I find it enough,"
Kemp said. I should esteem it a favour.
Very well. Templeton assumed an air of fatigue. Bindman, you can go. I will dress myself this morning.
Dress yourself, sir?
The valet's attentive bearing was ruffled by solicitude and surprise.
Yes, 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 dress myself. Blood man, do you think me a puppet with no independent powers of locomotion? Go, sir, and tell Biggs to send away all those who are waiting. I'll have no time for anyone this morning.
Kemp waited till the servant had withdrawn before resuming. He was telling Templeton what, for the most part, the latter knew already. The local assembly in Kingston, elected by popular vote in the colony and controlling the purse strings, was bringing pressure to bear on the governor, whose salary they also controlled, to authorise policies hostile to the interests of the absentee landlords, whom Kemp represented. They were seeking to confiscate tracts of land and to redistribute them among small farmers on the island. These measures, of course, were opposed by His Majesty's government.
Or they should be, sir, Kemp said. If they are not, we're abandoning one of the most sacred duties of government, which is the preservation of property. The great end of men's entering into society in the first place is the enjoyment of their properties in peace and safety.
That is most certainly true, sir. And this present administration of my Lord Rockingham, in which I have the honour to serve, has ever been dedicated to ensuring it.
Kemp's air of nonchalance fell away as he sat forward abruptly.
Then why is this policy allowed to continue unchecked? He demanded. The legislation is there. Why is it not enforced? Why, above all, are you not more active on our behalf in view of the sums, the very considerable sums, that you have received? Why am I thus obliged to come in person here and wait on your pleasure and consume my time away? Do you think I find it agreeable, sir? Do you think I find it congenial? Do you?
Good God!
Templeton was shocked at the blaze of antagonism that had come to the other's eyes.
How can I answer you?
He said. He had an impulse to get up and put the dressing table between them. It was almost as if the fellow were gathering for a spring, as he said later that day to a crony at White's.
I tell you, I feared for my person, he said, and there was nothing there but the stick with my wigs on, which that wretch Bindman had left behind.
It had seemed inexplicable, this spasm of fury, quite out of keeping with their conversation, which had been progressing on accustomed lines. Templeton was astute enough, but we never fully succeed in understanding what we cannot feel, and so he did not suspect the sense of outrage that had come to Kemp to find himself using the same language, exchanging similar phrases with a man he so despised, as if they were both of the same kidney, as if he had waded through the years only to make an embrace of minds with this depraved fop. If he had suspected anything of this, Templeton would have found it grotesque in a man who was so strenuously engaged in protecting his own interest. That he did not suspect it was a mark of virtue and a nature not otherwise richly endowed with this commodity. He was venal and corrupt, but he did not dignify his motives to himself, only to others.
"It is not so simple,"
he said now, in a tone he strove to make conciliatory.
Let me play the adversary for a while and point out to you the arguments on the other side. The plantations you speak of are owned by landlords who do not set foot on the island once in 10 years. Their estates are mismanaged by overseers regrettably subject to the corruption of the climate, in other words, liquor and whores, sir, and milked by dishonest attorneys, with consequent loss of duty to the crown, at a time when the demand for sugar is rising. Then there is a disproportion in population, with dangers of a slave revolt. There must be found some way of encouraging more Englishmen to settle in the colony. There were barely 25,000 in the last count, against more than 100,000 blacks. The deficiency laws have failed to restrain the practice of absenteeism, hence the clamour for redistribution of land in the local assembly. There are those in Parliament sympathetic to these demands, especially among the followers of Chatham. Need I name him to you?
Kemp looked down for a while in silence. His anger had gone, leaving a certain familiar sense of desolation.
No, you need not, he said. I know well enough who they are. For us, you see, the issue is simple, in spite of what you say. We are ready to guarantee an income for the governor, whomever he be, that will make him independent of the Assembly. But The real change must come in the workings by which the decisions of the council are put into effect. The council has the power, the statutory power, to disallow local legislation, even when backed by the governor. If there is delay, it must be because some person or persons are obstructing the procedure. This is not a question of legislation, it is a question of influence. That is why you were approached in the first place, so that you could use your voice behind the scenes. But how strong was this voice, he wondered, looking at the rouged and sorrowful face before him, with its thick eyebrows and slight, incongruous simper. And how often and how earnestly was it being raised? It had been his private belief for some time now that Templeton was taking bribes from the opposite party, too. Men like this, grown old in the practice of chicanery, were difficult to frighten for long.